ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Is the garage door up? It is. Do we have the keys? We do.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby, hello.
G'day, Phil.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
You just mentioned to me before we came on air that you'd driven 2,100 kilometres in the last 3 days.
I've been jetting around the country a little bit. Well, driving around the country a bit,
I was going to say, where have you been? Where have you been, man?
Canberra, Central West, so Dubbo, Mudgee, Bathurst. Did a driverless lap of Mount Panorama, so it was...
A driverless lap?
Driverless lap, yeah.
Hang on, what? In a driverless car?
Yeah, well, in the full self-driving Tesla. So I didn't touch anything for the whole thing, so, yeah.
You went round Mount Panorama?
Yeah.
Without touching the wheel?
Mm-hmm. Or the brakes or the steering wheel.
You look in one piece. There are no bandages, I can see.
No, and it's fair to say.
You didn't touch the steering wheel or the brake?
No.
Or the accelerator?
No. So it's...
Well... Well, hang on, what speed were you going? 10 k's an hour or something?
No, up to 60. Okay. So, 60's the limit around there.
So when you went up around the top of the mountain, it took all those bends?
Took all the bends, yeah. It actually did pretty well. And obviously the big thing, you can't take the racing lines. It's a two-way road at the moment. Yeah, so you've got to drive on the left-hand side. And I was interested to see whether it would obey that because there are no lines on there in terms of centre lines. But it did all right. Yeah, it did pretty well. I mean, it was a leisurely lap. It wasn't going to set any lap records, but it didn't break the rules at any point. So yeah.
I use that. I mean, look, a lot of modern cars have got this cruise control, adaptive thing at the moment, which I've used quite a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, provided the conditions are right, it does look quite a lot of driving for you, actually.
It does. I find those systems useful on, so single lane country roads, for example. I think they work pretty well.
Yeah.
They do get confused. They occasionally get confused, and you can get some phantom braking sometimes if they spot something else. Sometimes it's a reflection off a sign or something like that. I find on freeways, you take the Newcastle Expressway, for example, north of Sydney. The Geelong Freeway, where you've got those big multi-lane freeways that are typically pretty busy, and I find they don't work as well on that because they're often leaving huge gaps and it's cut and thrust on those, so you end up with people cutting in, and sometimes they brake. They can't. They never look 2, 3, 4 cars ahead. They're only ever looking at the car in front. So if that car in front either brakes late or early, you're caught up in that same sort of braking, whereas often you can adjust what your car's doing. If you're braking yourself, you'll be looking further ahead and trying to adapt.
Yeah. All right. Vehicle sales figures out this month. Chinese brands are killing it.
They sure are. Yeah. I mean, it's...
BYD up 140%.
144%. Chery up 105%. GWM up 17%. So, yeah, extremely strong month for... a strong year. If you look at their year-to-date sales, they're actually better than that for all those three brands. So, and where has it come from? Well, Ford, Mazda, Volkswagen have all declined, so they've had a tougher month. Volkswagen's well down these days.
Volkswagen seems to have dropped their bundle or something, or dropped their game. What are they trying to do these days? Because
they're in a world of hurt. This
is funny about car companies, isn't it? You know, like it just looks as though they've suddenly. Someone wasn't paying any attention for 18 months. And there's nothing in the design pipeline. And so they all of a sudden don't seem to have any cars, which anyone wants to buy.
Absolutely. And also they used to sort of almost own that sort of premium mainstream market.
Yeah.
And they've well lost that now. They've also lost the support of a lot of their dealers. Their dealer satisfaction is well down on where it should be.
Okay.
So what
actually goes on here, do you think? I mean, these are boardroom decisions, presumably, aren't they? I mean,
I mean, what goes on? Volkswagen, as I said, used to, you know, particularly things like interior finishes and materials and so on, they sort of reset the benchmark of what we expect from mainstream cars. They've since let that slip. They've since let that fall off a little bit, and the competitors have just overtaken them, just gone, bang, see you later. They've been extremely slow to things like hybrid, and they've been, they still don't have a decent hybrid lineup. And they've had, their shift towards EV, again, was super slow and is pretty underwhelming.
It's pretty underwhelming. Although, that being said, I ran into not one, but two, within the space of 5 minutes, electric combis.
Oh, yeah, the ID Buzz. That's a pretty cool-looking thing. It's just about 20 or 30 grand too expensive. So,
what do they cost a fortune?
90-odd, but they've been doing $15,000-odd discounts on them. Yeah. And that's when you start seeing car companies doing discounts. And the other thing, Volkswagen, Amarok, for example, the Ute, they're trying to force those on dealers. They've had some Amaroks that are, you know, 2023 models, so they're still pretty old cars kicking around in the dealer network. So they're just in a bit of pain.
Yep. Okay. RAV4 top selling car. Ranger number 2, Hilux 3.
Yeah. I mean, look, RAV4. This is pretty amazing for this car because it's towards the end of its life. That current RAV4. It came out in 2019.
There's a new model coming.
Yeah, all new model, which they've already shown off. They've already announced pricing for. And the old car is...
So can you get a cheap deal on the old ones?
Not at the moment. it's funny. Hilux, for example, which is just in model changeover now, the new ones are hitting dealerships this weekend, I think, or next weekend, or next week, sorry. But Hilux, they basically didn't discount towards the end of the current Hilux. And it's looking like they'll probably go a similar way with RAV4 because they've timed the run out well. Typical Toyota fashion, the prices of the new ones are more expensive. So it gives, I guess, a bit of an incentive for the people who don't want to stretch their budget. And the old ones still stack up reasonably well, particularly the RAV4. It's feeling a little bit tired inside, but the hybrid drivetrain is still pretty competitive. And, you know, in that market, as I said, there are better mid-sized SUVs around these days, but the RAV4 still has a loyal following.
Electric Utes, we have talked about them for quite a long time on the program, but they're on the way.
They're here now. So KGM, which is the rebranding of SsangYong, the Korean brand, has just started selling a version of the Musso, the EV electric version of the Musso. It's quite different to the regular Musso. It's actually a very different car. The only similarity really is the name. So it's more of a soft roader type thing, more of a lighter duty car, a bit of a lifestyle-y type ute.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's more coming. So Toyota will have an electric Hilux on sale next year. And that is predominantly aimed at fleets, particularly mining fleets. But if anyone wants to buy one, they can go and get it. What we haven't seen on yet, that is the full details and the pricing. But
what do you think they'll be roughly? We don't know yet.
A decent whack more than the standard Hilux, I think. But that said, it's expected to have a relatively small battery. So the battery is the expensive thing in an electric car. And the details that we've seen from overseas suggest that the battery is going to be fairly small on that car. So that will help, I think, help them position it a little bit closer to reality. But, you know, they've got a ready-made market there. The mining fleets in particular are desperate for...
Electric cars.
Yeah, they want to... They're trying to green their fleet. And you know, you look at... They've got a fairly specific use case. They don't have to go... driving 500 or 1,000 k's a day. They're back to base. They're always back to the same place.
Yeah.
So once they've got the charging sorted out, it's a pretty easy one for them.
That's true.
So, but yeah, and there's also Isuzu's doing an electric ute. Again, not much range, and I'm not sure how that'll go in terms of acceptance. And Nissan, the Frontier Pro. Now, this is another one of those sort of lifestyle type utes. So, again, things like independent suspension, not as heavy a payload, all that sort of stuff. But but again, they've confirmed that's coming to Australia. So yeah, as I said, there's some here now, but there's more coming over the next sort of
year
or two.
Is it too early to say what's the best one around?
I mean, yeah, definitely.
In the way that you know, we'd always say Ranger or Hilux are the two utes you should buy.
There are so many unknowns with these electric utes in terms of, and it's going to be funny, right? Because some of the traditional ute buyers, these are just not going to suit them at this stage. They'll just say, not going to work for me. I'm not going to deal with, you know, 250 k's of range or whatever. I need a lot more than that. So, yeah, I think it's far too early at this stage to say, but I think it's going to depend enormously on how you're planning to use that car. Like it's, you know, again, if you're someone who tows and, you know, want to go up the coast or across the country into the outback, probably not going to suit you at this stage, but you know, I guess you got to start somewhere. And within the next few years, I'd be surprised if we didn't see some with longer range, bigger payloads, all that sort of stuff.
Okay, let's grab some calls. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Lines are free. Grab one. Trevor from Wollongong. G'day, Trev.
G'day, Toby. Need some advice. I have a granddaughter just starting to drive, and her parents want to get a novated lease on an EV for her. But some of the ones they've looked at are not suitable for P-platers.
Tesla.
a lot of them. I think even the BYD Dolphin premium version, you know, the power-to-weight ratio is too high. Do you have any recommendations on...
Well, just pull back in terms of the power. So obviously on your Ls, you can drive anything. You can stick them in a Ferrari or Lamborghini, no problems, go for your life. But the P-plate's the issue. You basically, look, with the EVs, obviously, it's the dual motor ones that are more powerful and are pretty quick. And a lot of them are seriously quick these days. I mean, you can get genuine performance, supercar-like acceleration, what we called supercar acceleration 5 years ago in a $60,000 or $70,000 EV. So there's huge performance there. And, the way around it is obviously to get then the single motor one, the less powerful versions is the only option you're going to have unless they want to learn on the powerful one and then step down once you get the, once they get their piece. But I find like it's interesting, you go back 10, certainly 20 years, and particularly the European cars, the entry-level engines that they used to put in them were pretty gutless and pretty ordinary to drive. And you always used to say, okay, you can get one for that money, but really you want to spend another 10 or 15 to get the decent engine. There are very few EVs these days where I'm not seriously impressed by the entry-level ones. The base cars are generally, I find, really good. A Tesla, for example, I'd be more than happy in the base cars. A lot of them, a lot of the newcomers, the Zeekers and MGs and all that sort of stuff into that EV space, again, the single motor versions tend to work pretty well, I reckon. So I'd encourage them, I guess, to look at those single motor versions, but otherwise you just got to look for a brand or a model that's going to hit the or tick the P-plater box.
At 02, have you had a drive of that yet?
I haven't. I'm trying to get into one, the BYD. So that starts at around $35,000. And I haven't been in one of those yet. But,
they're only about 140 kilowatts or something. So they'd probably be in the permissible level.
Limit, I mean, obviously it's power to weight that they focus on with
that's
that.
Right.
But, that's certainly one. An MGS5, things like that. So there's ones out there that you'll be able to get, but it's just maybe pulling back the expectations from the top of the range one and go to one of the lower level ones and have a look at that. Kia EV3 would be another one. Stick that on the list. That's a really great fun car to drive, and it's pretty cool. And that would certainly stick.
It's a lot of money.
40 something. 43, 44, 45, somewhere around that. So it's
You're right, Trev. It's a lot of money. That's right.
For what you get in the car, you tend to get a lot more in some of the Chinese ones. I know that the Kia EV3 is a good car, but I think want anything below the base one, they're right up there.
Yeah, that's right. You're right in terms of showroom spec, the stuff you see on the equipment list and the amount of gear they've got in them, the Chinese are... destroying everyone with that at the moment, petrol or electric, doesn't matter. You then start, I guess there are trade-offs. So that EV3 Kia, for example, no, it's got nothing like the lengthy list of equipment that its rivals do in that entry-level car, but it is one of the best driving cars. So I guess they put the money into the core engineering, into the way it drives, all that sort of stuff, so it makes up points elsewhere. But loses them on sheer value. So
okay, all right, Trev. Good luck.
Okay, thanks.
Good luck, mate. Thank you. Text call. I'll get to text questions too. Grimesy says, "Team, does Joe Root get to 150 tonight? He might. He's under 132. Good on him. Good on him.
At least we're going to get a decent match, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully,
exactly. Brian from WA. G'day, Brian.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Toby. How are you going?
Yeah, good.
It came about that I heard on the news today that the estimates from companies building EVs, for some reason they're overestimating, maybe they're getting better or worse in terms of estimating electric vehicles. So my question is about, is there anything on average that electric vehicles are decreasing in efficiency? In other words, wear away in some particular way? Is there a common problem that's occurring that the...
This is the AAA, the Australian Automobile Association test that said that EVs aren't meeting their claimed range, yeah?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've done one of these before, and leaping to the defence of the car companies, all the car companies are doing is adhering to an Australian design rule in terms of the test that you have to do is stipulated by the government. So I would say it's not necessarily the car companies are the issue here. It's the test. The test is not accurate in terms of how people, Aussies in particular, use their cars, and it is by no means limited to electric vehicles. You go and buy any petrol or diesel car, and I challenge the average person to meet that figure you see on the windscreen in terms of litres per 100. Now, you can do it if you drive absolutely gently and take it easy and only have one person in the car, all that sort of stuff. And similarly, in an EV, you can do it 100%. So is there something going on? No, as I said, I think it's the test. The government needs to look at the way the test is done. It's called ADR 8101. So it's a standard they all have to meet and basically have to claim a range figure. But the one we do is very good. It is basically NEDC, the old European system. Now, the Europeans worked out it's not really relevant because it's not super accurate, so they changed to a thing called WLTP. And an easy way for us would be to come out and say, okay, we'll do the WLTP instead and run with that, which, again, okay, is not 100% accurate, but I have been able to match it. I can certainly match it more easily in an EV than I can in a petrol car as a general rule. But as I said, petrol, diesel, electric, whatever, I find all of them generally don't hit their numbers. So it's not more the test.
So the estimates, when you say, you know, we're for the Utes, the EV Utes, and their range at the moment, is that an accurate estimate? Or because of these tests, and I'm not having a go at the car companies, but because of these tests, is it at the moment overestimating or...?
So we haven't seen what Toyota's, what they're saying the Hilux will be. We've only seen some figures from overseas, and that number I was giving you, the 250-odd, was more of a realistic one, yes. So it's more of a I think it'll sit in terms of everyday driving. And what I normally say to people, so most car companies in Australia now do quote the WLTP range for EVs. So they some of them will quote both. They do have to supply that NEDC figure to the government, but most of them in their marketing material will quote that WLTP figure. But I still say to everyone, knock about 10% off that for your everyday driving, and if you're on a freeway, knock about 20% off it to get an estimate of how far it'll go.
Okay.
So
okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
No worries. Thanks, Brian. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222. There are lines free. John from Townsville. Thanks for waiting on, John. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, g'day, John.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. What's your question? Yeah,
Hi, Toby.
G'day.
Now, my question is, I just wanted to comment on the electronic awareness systems in the new cars, like your alerts and so forth that come up.
Mm.
I bought some new vehicles in recent times, and I had issues with the unnecessary warning devices and so forth and a lot of that stuff. And I was
Stop bloody beeping at me.
That's right. And I was able to turn it off by going into the system.
Mm-hmm.
However, any of those you can't turn off, I found when I put it in for a service and I instructed them what I wanted to do, they got the brain box out and plugged it into the loom under the dash, the diagnostic system kit, and they were able to switch the things off that I wanted switched off.
Yeah, right.
And I found that very helpful.
Yeah, right.
The other thing I wanted to mention about this is in the current Wheels magazine, this is an example, there's a report on the new on a Ford Mustang Dark Horse, mm-hmm, that this journalist has taken from Hobart to Adelaide,
mm-hmm,
and he's commented on the fact that the lane changing alert was coming on and it was bumping the steering wheel and making announcements. Now that's only a matter of pushing a button twice and mm-hmm, it switches that off,
mm-hmm,
and the other one was the one with the motion detector, which is for vandalism and obvious other reasons, it's on. And when they put the car on the barge down there in Hobart, it came on. And that's another one that can be switched off straight away from your steering wheel.
Mm.
But the other thing is with some journalists, I'm not having a go at Toby, but some journalists seem to make a big deal out of a lot of these things that the dealers should probably switch off before the, the dealers take for a run, because they are annoying and they can.
They are annoying. I mean, you've talked about this in the past, haven't you, Toby, about how you can switch them off?
Yeah, it's ridiculous that, I mean, you shouldn't need to switch this stuff off. You go back to the early days of anti-lock brakes, and a few cars back in, I'm thinking when it would have been, early 90s, something like that, a few cars back then, you could switch off the anti-lock brakes because they were very ordinary in terms of how they just used to be too clunky, and you'd hit a bump and it would all of a sudden you'd increase your braking distance. Now, these days, I'm not aware of any cars where you can switch off the ABS because they all generally do a pretty good job. Some of them do a brilliant job of, doing what they say on the box. But a lot of these other systems, lane departure warning is one of the worst, and I just constantly end up going in trying to figure out how I can turn the things off, because which defeats the purpose of having them. Like the car companies are getting pushed into having these systems to some extent by independent crash testing, because they're stipulating they have them, and the owners are doing everything they can to switch them off because they're not doing what they're supposed to do, and all they do is annoy you. So it's and in some instances they can be dangerous, but otherwise they can just be annoying. Interesting that you mentioned the ferry and the car moving. I took a Ford Ranger onto Gari, Fraser Island, 4 or 5 months ago, something like that, chucked it on the ferry, and got upstairs, and next thing you know, there's an alarm going off, and the ferry guy gets on and says, "Who's got the 2 Ford Rangers?" And anyway, we went and they said, "Leave the keys in them and do this and that." And I went and spoke to the guys, and I said, "Is that a common thing?" They said, "Mate, every time we got Rangers on here, Rangers or Everest, Ford Everest." Yeah. And they said, "Every time we have to go and tell people how to do it and how to stop the alarms going off." So, you know, it's a fairly specific case with that, but, you can go into the menu and deactivate it, but they generally just say leave the keys in the car and stop the alarm going off, basically.
Okay. Bob from Benora Point. Toby, what are the better suggestions in the category of the RAV4? You mentioned there's many better yet, but there's still a loyal base of RAV4 buyers.
Yeah, that's right.
But you reckon there's better things than RAV4?
Better things, yeah.
Like what?
I think the Kia Sportage is probably one of the standouts, closely followed by the Hyundai Tucson, which they're the same basic car underneath. So those two are really great buying. I think the Nissan X-Trail stacks up pretty well, more so the e-Power one, the hybrid version. The regular one isn't nearly as convincing. So there's three to kick off with that I think do a better job than the current RAV4, and it's partly age. They're newer vehicles. As I said, the RAV4 is towards the end of its life. It still stacks up well. It's a very competitive market segment. I think it's the single biggest market segment in Australia, but as I said, I reckon there's some cars in there that are slightly better.
There you go, Bob. Hey, the luxury car tax.
Back on the agenda.
I know you've been griping about this for a long time, and for good reason, because it's a completely arbitrary tax, which just...
Well, it's the only thing in Australia that gets a luxury tax.
That's right.
Is cars.
Yeah.
You buy a helicopter, a yacht, whatever.
Or a boat.
Any of that stuff. And you can spend millions on them and you don't get any luxury car tax. You go and buy a Toyota Land Cruiser, you get slugged with luxury car tax.
Which is, on a Land Cruiser, about what?
It depends on the model, but $150,000 Land Cruiser, I think, so the top of the range one, I think it's about $15,000, something like that.
It's not nothing.
Definitely not nothing. So it's 33% on everything over roughly $75,000, $78,000, unless you get EVs, and then it's on over about $91,000.
It's nuts, isn't it?
It's crazy.
You can go and buy $1 million yacht.
Yeah, because the reason it initially came in was to try to protect the local industry, to look after the top shelf Holden Commodores and Ford Falcons, the Statesmans and all that sort of stuff.
Which don't exist anymore.
They don't exist anymore. They haven't for years. So why are we doing that? And the reason is because the government last year, I think it was $1.2 billion of revenue. That's the reason. They're just sitting there saying, well, and once, you know, when people start arcing up about it, they say, well, hang on a minute, who cares? This is for luxury cars, expensive cars.
It's only for rich people anyway.
That's it.
But let's slug them more.
But the brand that pays more luxury car tax than any other in Australia is Toyota, because they sell so many Land Cruisers and some of the Prados and that sort of stuff. So they're paying a heap of luxury car tax.
There you go.
But it's back on the agenda because we're trying to negotiate a free trade agreement with the European Union. And Germany's a very strong part of that, and Germany does a lot of luxury cars, and they're sort of saying, hang on a minute, if you want a free trade agreement, let's talk about this.
Okay, Ben from Perth. G'day, Ben.
G'day, Philip. Hello, Toby. Philip, just quickly, second best show on the ABC, mate, and only beaten by Richard Feidler's Conversations.
I'll cop that, Ben. I'll cop that.
Beautiful. And you're a great combo, you two. Always a pleasure listening to you both. Toby, my question was understanding the revolution in the EV market and how that impacts on sort of day-to-day driving and all the rest of it. But who was out there actually advocating for and pushing, you know, improved road design, things that lead to efficiencies in how vehicles operate? Just to give you an example, in my neighbourhood in Perth, there's a large shopping precinct near my house. They've removed a lot of the slip lanes and forced traffic to go to red-green lights, which, you know, to me is sort of nonsensical in the context of trying to keep vehicles moving and trying to reduce fuel consumption and emissions from just your standard cars. What body is out there other than people maybe riding to their shires or their councils or whatever, who is actually advocating for improved road design so, say, the people that aren't in EVs are still getting a benefit from, you know, not having to stop at every traffic light?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I guess the motoring clubs are one of them, you know, NRMAs and RACVs and RACs over your end of the world, that sort of thing. Those, I think they sometimes go down that path. Often, obviously, a lot of the conversation with road design centres around safety, which is fine. We obviously don't want people getting injured or killed on the roads. But equally, traffic flow is an important one. And I know where you're coming from in terms of I chatted to someone in a university years ago about trying to do a study on, you know, take a freeway, for example, where there might be a little, you know, it goes downhill and then goes into a big uphill. Are we better off from an environmental point of view, letting the cars run to an extra 10 or 20 k's an hour down the hill so they can then have more momentum going up the hill so they don't waste brakes going down and they don't use more fuel going up the hill? But ultimately, then someone says, hang on a minute, 100 k's an hour is safe, 101 kilometres an hour isn't safe. Every kilometre an hour counts, and we get this. End up with this debate, and safety tends to win. But I'm with you in terms of I think we need to start thinking more about that flow. It's far less of an issue with EVs because they've got regenerative braking. Obviously, they can store some of that energy and reuse it. But you know, 19.5 odd million of the vehicles on our road are powered by petrol and diesel. So they need to be considered. So yeah, but in terms of who's advocating, as I said, motoring clubs potentially, but I think really it comes down to the public needs to, there need to be a lot of people who don't like what's going on, and we probably don't have that momentum yet.
And I guess just quickly, Philip, just like things like traffic lights where, you know, you've got no traffic coming. Yeah. I think in New Zealand you're allowed to turn left if there's no traffic coming against the red light, things like that.
Yeah.
Just sort of seems to waste of energy, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's in New South Wales. They've got left turn on red as well. So it's so in some parts of the country, you've got that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, traffic light. I think in some parts of the world, they've got traffic lights where you can, you know, take it late at night where you can see there's no one coming and you drive up to it and you're waiting. You have to wait for it to trigger it and then it'll go your way. Some parts of the world, I think they've got ones where you can flash, for example, just high beam the light and it'll see the reflection, see there's a car coming, and then go and trigger the light so that when you're there, you don't have to stop and then start again. It just lets you flow through. So there's technology like that that I would have thought these days would be pretty simple. You could use, you know, camera-based technology and AI and all sorts of stuff to, on major intersections or even on smaller ones where there's not a whole lot of traffic at night, to sort of look what's coming rather than force the cars to stop. So, yeah, there's a technology thing there, but obviously all that starts costing money, and I don't think a whole lot of governments are flush with a lot of that at the moment.
Okay.
No. Great talking to you both.
On your Ben. Thank you. Yes, 1-300-800-222. Brisbane is the home of Luke, who's on the line. G'day, Luke.
Oh, hello, gents. Toby, you mentioned in a previous segment the difference between the Tesla Model 3 and the BYD Seal. You mentioned that the Tesla was better in performance. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate.
Oh, probably more, so not necessarily straight out performance, more the overall driving experience. So I think the...
Yeah, that's what I meant. That's what I meant.
Yeah, and the previous, so they updated the Model 3, 2 years ago now, 18 months ago, something like that, and it made a massive difference because they Tesla did a lot of work on particularly suspension tuning, building a lot of compliance into it. So a lot more comfortable. The early ones were pretty rock hard in the suspension, so they were a little bit testing in terms of the ride quality. So they seriously improved the car on that front. They improved it on noise, so it was quieter, and they improved performance slightly, and also just the way it drives. I mean, Teslas, they do actually drive reasonably well. They're certainly not perfect by any stretch, and there's better driving EVs out there. Things like a Hyundai Ioniq 5, for example, is a pretty cool car. But if I'm talking really broadly, I think some of the Chinese brands need to work on their dynamics. That's probably the one little area at the moment that they need to fix up. They've fixed up things like styling and safety and quality and all these things that they got criticized for over the last decade or so. The one that they haven't attacked head on at the moment, most of them, and I'm talking generally here, is that dynamic side, how the cars drive. So it's just a little bit of that suspension tuning and making it, you know, giving it a bit of that tied down feel, a good balance between dynamics and how it tips into a corner and how it pampers you over bumps and stuff. So things like that, I think the Tesla's a bit ahead.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Luke. Thank you. This is Motor Talk.
Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
Your calls, 1300 800 222 is the number. Greg's in Fremantle. G'day, Greg.
Good morning. Good evening, Phil.
G'day.
I have an Econovan at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I want to trade up to an LDV van, electric.
Yep.
I take a lot of load in the back. I live in Perth. I go, say, sometimes from Mandra to Fremantle, Mandra to Joondalup sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How economic is it with a big load in the back?
It's an interesting one. I spoke to some Ford engineers about this a year or two ago and asked them exactly that. You know, what happens when you put half a ton in the back of your van or your electric van? What's going to happen with it? And they said, sure, you're going to need some more energy to drag it around. But they said it's actually not quite as much as what you might think in terms of, they said by far the bigger impact on an EV's range is towing. And the point they were making was that if you look at most tow vehicles, whether it's a boat or a caravan, most of them aren't particularly aerodynamic. They're usually sort of boxes or weirdly shaped things that don't exactly slice through the air. So they can create quite a big drag on the car. And that's something that if you look at vehicle design generally across any type of car, the last 10 or 20 years, aerodynamic gains have been huge. They've made massive inroads in terms of not only smoothing the airflow over the car, but reducing things like lift, getting rid of noise, all by doing tiny little aerodynamic details. You go over any car these days, it's all these little things you start spotting of, okay, that's why they've done that. Things like often if you look on a car, you'll see on the mirrors, it's got little dimples on the mirrors, on the exterior wing mirrors. And those dimples aren't about design, they're about reducing wind noise, for example. Mm. So it's, you know, little things like that they throw in there to try and sort out things like that. And have a look at the back end of a lot of cars these days. They've often got quite sharp edges over the back of the car, whether it's the taillights or the way the boot folds or whatever. And that's all about separating the airflow at higher speeds. So if you're sitting at 100, you don't want the air sort of swirling around the back of the car. You want it flying over the car, getting to that tail end, and basically separating straight away so that it creates a clean break from the car and doesn't create drag. So, yeah, as I said, a lot of that going on. So coming back to your question about the weight, yes, it will make a difference, but all the research I've done, all the discussions I've had with people suggest it's not nearly as big as what you might think. So if I'm guessing 5%, maybe 10%, something like that, but obviously it's going to depend on exactly what you got in the car and how much, you know, the vehicle itself. You'd have to sort of test it and see what's going on.
Okay. The other question is when, let's say my car runs out of electric,
runs out of charge, yeah.
Yep. What's the process of, can I jump start it? Can I get it towed?
Certainly you can get it towed. Yeah. So the process is charge it, but how you charge it's the real thing. So A lot of the motoring clubs, I believe they now have it on some of their service vehicles. So if you break down, you know, whereas previously they might have a small jerry can, or they, you know, they got the basic tools to try and get your car going again. Now they're working on having a small battery pack. So a way they can put in a small amount of charge, just to get you another 5, 10, 20 Ks, whatever it might be. But otherwise you've got to get it to a, so you can't jump start it. You can jump start an electric vehicle, but you're jump starting the 12-volt battery, not the high voltage battery. So all EVs run a 12-volt battery, same as any other car on the road. And that 12-volt battery is used for lights, adjusting your seats, radio, all that sort of stuff. So you can't jump start it because it's going to then try and rely on the high voltage battery, which doesn't have any charge in it once you're out. So you need to get it plugged in somewhere is the short story, whether that's roadside service or plugging into a standard power point. You know, you can do that. It'll just take a while to get you the charge you need. But I've said before, you do have to work pretty hard to run an EV out, because they start warning you and beeping at you and coming up with things saying, do you want to find a charging station? So you've got to work at it to run out. You can do it, but it's, you know, you'll get a few warnings before that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Going to Greg. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222 if you want to grab a line and ask Toby a question as well. You've driven three new cars from Chinese newcomer GAC, the N-Zoom, the Aeon 5 and the M8.
Yeah, the Aeon or the Ion V.
Aeon, I've no idea how you pronounce it.
No, I was asking a whole bunch of people at the launch, and everyone's like, oh, I say Ion, and other people say Aeon. But yeah, this is yet another new brand. It's almost every week we're talking about new brands, but well, I think
Are
it is
any good?
Every fortnight. They're actually surprisingly good in some ways. So the M-Zoom, for example, is a $25,000-odd small SUV, petrol-powered, and incredible value in terms of the features in there. It's got, often you find things like the sound system on those entry-level cars is pretty ordinary, but it's actually a half-a-ride sound system. It's got an electric driver's seat. It's got a panoramic sunroof. It's got a whole bunch of gear in there, and it's presented pretty well. Where it falls a bit short is the transmission. It's got one of these dual-clutch transmissions, and just like a lot of Volkswagens and so on, it can be jerky and hesitate the way it takes off. So it's a little bit frustrating with that. It is a pretty ordinary transmission in it. But the rest of the car is actually not too bad. It's again, astonishing value. And the other one, the Ion V, is mid-sized electric SUV, full electric. And again, the value on it is incredible. It's sort of $45,000 and loaded to the gunnels with gear. It's probably the blandest one to drive. So it's a little bit nothing in terms of the way it drives. But the space in it, the range it gets, the electric range it gets, a whole bunch of other things actually stack up pretty well. The weird one's the M8, the top of the range one. It's a people mover with a massive grille. It's like this huge, toothy.
A lot of the Chinese cars like this. They like this.
And they
kind
like
of thing.
Chrome. They get that.
They love this big
glistening
chrome front.
And it certainly stands out. If you want to stand out, that's a great car for you. But it's playing in the luxury end of the people mover market, which. People mover market's not big anyway. And then you say, okay, $80,000. There's not a whole heap of people lining up to spend 80 grand on a people mover, particularly one they haven't heard of. But it actually drives pretty well. It's a plug-in hybrid. And space-wise, again, inside it's huge. And it's got two captain's chairs in the back, so full luxury in the back. And then the third row is three seats, so it's sort of, you're a little bit relegated to economy back there.
I must say, having ridden in some of these things,
because they're
very common in Asia, and the captain's seat luxury people mover. If someone else is at the wheel, it's not a bad way to get around.
No, that's right. And look, that's you start to understand going to somewhere like China.
Yeah.
If you're wealthy in China, often the person doesn't like driving. They want to be driven around. So they want to be in the back seat or that comfy chair in the middle there.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of these cars exist over in places like China. In Australia, if you're wealthy, you tend to buy the flash car and drive it yourself. The people like to do that here. So, different cultures, comes down to how they or why they do it like that.
Yeah. Lek and Burris says, Phil and Toby, does yesterday's announcement by Donald Trump rescinding Joe Biden's caveats on emissions targets for vehicle manufacturers, is it going to have an impact on EV markets from now on? Trump was surrounded by CEOs of US vehicle manufacturers, in inverted commas,
yeah,
while he signed another executive order. The move frightens me.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's interesting. He's obviously been pulling back. So he got rid of the – they had a $7,500 rebate on EVs, or incentive on EVs, and he got rid of that. I think it ended a month or so ago. And he's been making it pretty clear that obviously he's not interested in them. He thinks the whole climate thing's a hoax. So it's – so he is yeah, I mean, I've listened to some podcasts with some pretty people whose opinion I value in the US automotive industry about what this means for their industry and EVs generally, and they tend to think the general feedback I've heard on those podcasts is that they're thinking that it's going to send the US industry back 5 or 10 years, 15 years, because the rest of the world is not going to slow down on this. Reducing emissions generally. You know, you've got Europe going very heavy on that. You've got China going very heavy on that.
I mean, that's the point, isn't it? It's all real to say I'm not going to go with the tide.
Yeah.
But the tide's coming in.
That's right.
There's no point in planting your throne in the middle of it and saying stop.
No, that's it. And that's the thing I think is dangerous for those American car makers is if they just say, no, we're not going down that path, or we're not going to go down that path anymore, then it's going to make it pretty hard. But what you're tending to find they're doing, so, you know, Ram, for example, was trying to replace the Hemi V8 with an inline six-cylinder engine. They've still got the inline six-cylinder, but they've also are now bringing the Hemi V8 back to do more because there are buyers there. They don't have the emissions issues, all that sort of stuff. So they're sort of bringing back, to some extent, old tech, and we'll just stretch that out for a little bit longer because the buyers are there lining up for it. But I think it's important that they also say, we've still got to invest in hybrids, electric, all that sort of stuff, because that's where the world is going, even if America's not.
Yeah. Hey, there's no question that these days that electric cars are the most powerful. In fact, Porsche Cayenne has just demonstrated this with the release of its fully electric model, which has more than 1,000 horsepower and is more powerful than a V12 from Ferrari or Lamborghini.
Kills them.
Or Aston Martin. But they're also... they're also going to be the first EV that can be charged wirelessly. Now, some people might know there's a facility in my car that doesn't work, I must say, but you can buy wireless charging pads for your phone.
Yeah.
As I say, I don't know how well they work, but this is the same idea, is it? That you could potentially charge your car wirelessly by parking it over a pad.
Yeah, so it's induction charging, exactly the same as you can do with a phone. And as you say, some of them are pretty rubbish. Some of them are half all right, but most of them charge slower than you do when you plug in. And some of them you've got to be very finicky in terms of where you put the phone on the charging pad. But yeah, Porsche said with this Cayenne, it will have wireless charging. So yeah, as you say, a pad that you put in your driveway or your garage, and you drive over it, and it then sends up effectively a magnetic field to the car, and then the car receives that, turns it back into electricity, pops it in the battery.
How long is that going to take, though? I mean, well, it'd be slow, wouldn't it?
It will be relatively slow, but keep in mind that people generally are slow charging at home anyway. You're doing it overnight, so the car's stopped there for a fair while. So, yeah, I can't imagine this is going to be a fast charger option in the medium term. Maybe technology will change in 10, 20, 30 years, but at the moment it's shaping up to be more of a slower charge and overnight type of charge. And it's really just about convenience. It's, you know, instead of having to get home and get the heavy cable and plug it into the car.
So the idea is you'd buy one of these pads, stick it in your garage floor.
Yeah.
And hey presto.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So okay. So there's been a lot, you know, BMW did a fair bit of work on it and talked about it a lot maybe 4 or 5 years ago. They sort of went cold on it since. A lot of brands have looked at it and talked about it, and they've all said, oh, we can do this and we can do that. They've had issues with making it a reality in terms of production reality. They've shown it and that it works. But yeah, Porsche's now saying they're going to have it. The one thing, though, that's I remember back in the old days, 5 years ago, when people were talking about induction charging, they said the one thing is you obviously want it to be as close as possible to the charging pad, you know, similar to your phone. It's got to be sitting on it, basically. But, you know, every car pretty much is a different height. So you've got slightly different heights, and where's the receiver in the car? So there's a lot of different variables in there in terms of, you know, I would imagine it's going to have to be a charging pad set up for particular cars, at least in the early phases, to be able to work across. You know, it'll be set up basically for that car initially, I would have thought.
1-300-800-222 is my number. This is Motor Talk.
Nightlife with Philip Clark. on ABC Radio.
Hey, here's an interesting one. Toyota says it's going to do a hydrogen fuel cell version of the new Hilux.
Yeah, that's
really?
Right.
So
the new, we should call it the updated Hilux because there's a lot of old in the new.
As you said, it's basically a new grill and that's it. It's the same,
a little bit more, but
it's
yes.
It's the same engine. It's the same engine and the same everything.
Same body, doors, window, glass,
same body,
all that.
Same body, yeah.
And same chassis underneath. but they've tuned things differently. They put a new interior in it. They've put a new front on it, new back.
Ashtray.
Definitely new ashtray. Actually, it probably doesn't have an ashtray. That's right. But yeah, they're doing a hydrogen fuel cell of the updated Hilux. So it's so
they're still going down this road, are they?
100%. Oh, big time. So Toyota,
you can't really buy one though.
No, and you can't talk to a Toyota executive for more than a minute or two without them saying multi-pathway approach. So the multi-pathway approach, and look, they make a valid point, which is if you look at the car market now, we've got the choice between, you know, take EVs out, you've got the choice between hybrids, petrol, diesel. We've had LPG in the past. So it's different technologies potentially for different uses. And obviously diesel engines tend to gravitate towards larger, heavier workhorse type vehicles. Petrol engines for most of the other stuff. So it's looking like they think, Toyota thinks, and Toyota's a pretty smart car company, they're the top brand in the world. They think that there will be a mix of technologies, not just one, and that's why they're saying we are not just going battery electric.
Have you driven a hydrogen fuel cell car?
Yeah. Driven a few of them.
They're just like an electric car.
Yeah, they just drive like an electric car. So basically the hydrogen fuel cell performs a chemical reaction to convert the hydrogen into electricity.
So in terms of the way they drive, they just drive like an electric car.
Yeah, but they do have an exhaust pipe, and out of that exhaust pipe comes water. So I was telling my kids this, and they said, oh, that's cool. So what do you do with the water? And I said, well, it's completely clean water. So we strapped on a couple of plastic buckets to the back of it. I drove it around for about 5 kilometres, came back, and they drank the water. So it's pure water, basically. So the one thing you got to be careful of is the exhaust pipe itself is not dirty. But I wouldn't recommend that. But
do they plan? Because I mean, the whole problem is fuel networks here. And do they ever plan to sell you one? You can't buy one, can you?
No, you can lease one. Hyundai and Toyota both have ones you can lease here.
Yeah.
The Hilux, they're saying that you'll be able to buy them, and they're saying 2028 is when it will go on sale. You're right in terms of there is close to zero infrastructure at the moment.
Where are you going to get the hydrogen from?
Well, I think Toyota's going to either put some in or encourage putting them in. Because you've got other brands.
Make it with your home chemistry set.
Yeah. Well, theoretically, you can, just not enough of it. Yeah. But, Hyundai, for example, is also going pretty hard, and they see a role for it. BMW. BMW's actually got an agreement with Toyota. The two of them are working on the technology together. So BMW said they'll have a version of, I think it's the X5, by the end of the decade or something like that. Again, hydrogen
powered. So it's worked up technology.
Yeah, the technology works. It's it's all fine. It's just the challenge is purely one of infrastructure, of putting all that in. And that is an enormous challenge. And that's something the problem they're up against, I think, with these cars is battery electric vehicles. We've already seen charging times come down enormously, and they will keep coming down. So once you're getting to 5-minute recharges on an EV, do you really care about going to a hydrogen fuel cell? Don't know. But again, Toyota says there is a market for this.
Did I tell you about multi-pathway?
Yeah. That's right.
On you, Toby. Terrific. Fascinating as always. I think we've got one more before I go off on a break. So looking forward to that.
Sounds good.
So, you'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thanks, Tobes.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.